Hi, Not a Novel podcast fans. This is Grant. And even though you're probably listening to this whenever and wherever, this is the first time we've done the podcast in the evening. So I'm looking forward to seeing if that changes the conversation at all. I have Kimberly with me. Kimberly, you want to say hi?
Hello, everyone.
And Kimberly has chosen a topic near and dear to my heart. We're going to be kind of talking about the difference between what is considered adaptation and what is considered fan fiction. And I think what might help is, I'll just kind of say what I think the difference is. I'm trying to figure it out like everyone else is, but, for me, adaptation, as separate from appropriation is, when we're taking a text, and either transferring it into a new medium or telling it over again and changing a couple components, but the end result is that the story or text talks about society, the original text. It has some sort of greater commentary. And the distinction I make is fan fiction, which is kind of more pastiche, where it just, adds to the story, but doesn't really add anything new in terms of conversation. There is good fan fiction. I'm not saying all bad fan fiction operates this way. I think there's a lot of fan fiction that we actually probably should consider as adaptation. So we'll get into that more, but, Kimberly, do you want to talk about like what you're thinking? Are the differences between the two? What's complicating, defining these two things for you?
Yeah, I agree with pretty much what you said, that adaptation especially has some kind of a commentary for the source text, and that fan fiction, it seems to me to be like maybe an extension, like they wanted to see something happen in the story that didn't happen, so let's write it in, and just kind of more of a celebration for the most part of the text, where I think an adaptation can sometimes be critical of the text, though not necessarily so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some examples that I think, I'm thinking of Little Women and, the most recent film adaptation seems to conflate Louisa May Alcott with the protagonist. And, that does kind of bring a new take on it. And I think it has implications for how we think of authorship now. But it doesn't, I don't know, to me, it doesn't really say anything new about the role of women in writing or in society. As it did, compared to the source text, it does have a nice little dig. I don't know if it's very pronounced, but there's definitely a dig at the source text about this, its kind of refusal to deal with the Civil War. But that's like a passing moment. There was a real opportunity to kind of comment on the source text there that was kind of lost. And so I think, one reason why it might be really hard for us to define is we're so used to seeing things that we call adaptations that are really kind of like fan fictions. Mm. Kimberly and I were talking about the movie adaptation with Nicolas Cage. I'm trying to think. I think that was a Spike Jonze movie.
Yeah, it was.
I think it was. And, it's a movie about trying to adapt, you know, a movie of something. And, you know, the fact that it has that meta commentary, you know, kind of brings to light what really adaptation is about. It's about the process. It's about what changes and what decisions are made. And so, you know, there are decisions that are made when we're doing fan fiction. So Kimberly, what do you think kind of distinguishes those decisions? Because, you know, like in a fan fiction, I might decide to give voice to a minor character and try to flesh them out a little more. So why would you think like that, you know, that, because that implicates that maybe that character wasn't talked about because, you know, the character has some kind of identity that, you know, it's maybe a minority category or a person of color. And so what, you know, that almost is a political statement in itself, right? It's trying to bring more diversity to the text than the text originally had. So what do you think about like fan fiction that does something like that?
No, see, that's where I would be a little confused and where I was trying to figure out where the line is drawn between that being adaptation or fan fiction, because I understand there's going to be overlap between the genres as it is. But if it is like explicitly drawing out like a subaltern voice, I'm going to tend to think of that as, you know, some kind of political commentary. Just by the, like you said, by the act of it doing that, saying, hey, and I think the reading that we did, it was a really good example talking about Jane Eyre and then how there was an adaptation. Oh my goodness. And I don't remember.
Yeah. Wide Sargasso Sea.
Yeah. Thank you. So that, the adaptation there, and how she, the author, basically wanted to give a voice to this, you know, West Indian lady who was just basically, all we knew about her is that she was, like, was she from Jamaica? And she was insane. And so having so little information to go on, it's like, okay, so was Bronte trying to say that she was insane because of, like, were these things interrelated because we have such little information to go on? Why are these the little tidbits that we're allowed? So just by nature of writing about this character saying, hey, I'm going to, you know, take her out of the attic by giving her a voice and a platform in a whole other text as a political act. But at the same time, she's caught in the structure of the original source text. So it's like, is that fan fiction or is that adaptation? Like, it's really hard for me to make those kind of determinations, especially when there's a political component that I can see in the writing.
Yeah. I mean, Jean Rhys and the Wide Sargasso Sea is an interesting example because, you know, this is where I think, you know, we can start to draw the lines of good adaptation. And I think in the article, it was trying to distinguish between appropriating a text and adapting it. And appropriation is just, you know, I use to be or not to be, or I show someone holding a skull to try and like gesture towards a text, or I try to set something up like Romeo and Juliet in order to give it more gravity. Where, you know, in Wide Sargasso Sea is a good story outside of it being related to, you know, as being kind of a prequel to Jane Eyre. And I think that's an important distinction with, you know, fan fiction to adaptation is adaptation seems to be able to stand on its own as its own text, where you don't need the source text in order to understand it. But if you do know the source text, it kind of makes, reading it, richer. You know, because in Wide Sargasso Sea, you don't get Rochester's name, and you don't get Bertha Mason as a name until the end. So, you know, the book is marketed as this kind of post-colonial Jane Eyre. But before then, like, you don't even know that who these characters are until, like, you know, literally it just slides it right in at the end, maybe the last 5-6 pages of the novel. So, you know, it works on its own. And yeah, I think your point about the subaltern, you know, giving voice to texts that, you know, don't give voice to those groups of people. It's, you know, Charlotte Bronte was writing in the height of the British Empire. And so it has the kind of white middle class woman perspective that's kind of indicative of that time. And so, yeah, there is a political act in, you know, fleshing out a character like that. You know, one thing that's always interested me about Wide Sargasso is the fact that Jean Rhys is a white woman. And she writes this story that, I mean, it's well researched. There's a lot of really good allusions to Jamaica and what was going on in Jamaica at the time. But Kimberly, what do you think about this in terms of, you know, someone that doesn't necessarily have the experience of being someone like that, but writing them in? You know, there's another book. I forget the author. It was called Property, and it was about a story of an enslaved woman on a plantation. But it was also written by a white woman. And so I'm kind of interested in this of, you know, especially in the age we've been talking this class a lot about death of the author, and that, you know, in the age of the internet and social media, it's pretty hard to remove yourself from the text. So Kimberly, what do you think about that? What do you think about people writing, you know, like trying to give voice to a category of people that they're not a part of?
Yeah, I understand. Like that can be very controversial, but personally for me as a Black woman, I appreciate if it's, I guess depending on what it's trying to accomplish, but I appreciate even the recognition that those stories are important and that they need to be told. And then even more than that, I feel like it generates a conversation which allows people like me to enter in and then provide our own texts and our own experiences that may not be there otherwise if it wasn't for someone outside of those categories to, you know, start the conversation. So it's, I feel like it's really important work to be done. And then in addition to that, it's commendable that somebody can have an imagination that is outside their own reality, right? I think that's part of writing, part of art. Like, I don't want to construct worlds that always mimic my own, or, you know, society. Everybody in the book is just like me. That is so boring. So just to be able to think outside of myself and maybe just create or imagine or empathize with what someone else's experience might be, I think that's really necessary. And it really makes art richer. It makes it more useful, and it makes it, you know, creates a platform for other people to come behind and carry on the work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree. Like, it's, you know, Wide Sargasso Sea is accurate. You know, I think about all the care that people put into writing these kind of stories. Like, I finished Vincent Brown's recent book, Tacky's Revolt, about the revolts in Haiti before the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And the back of the book is insane. Like, he was looking for names of people on receipts, because, like, when an enslaved person bought something, They had to put their name on the receipt. And so he's looking through, like, you know, these little scraps of paper in the archive in order to figure out, like, the most accurate names he can give to people. And so I respect people that, like, yes, want to bring a new perspective, but also, like, take the care to make sure that they aren't, you know, producing the language of the enslaver, or they're not, or they're reproducing stereotypes. You know, there was a, I don't know if you saw, there was a controversy earlier this year about a novel called American Dirt, which a white woman wrote about a Mexican woman that comes to America illegally. And it's a good story. You know, it's a great story. And I understand it was trying to humanize people that come into this country illegally. But the issue of the book was that it it kind of contributed to racial stereotypes of Latinx people. And so the book had an enormous amount of backlash because of that. You know, like, everyone was very excited. It was like a Simon and Schuster book. It had, you know, like, I think Oprah initially had it on her book club and then had to recant it later because of the backlash. So I think that there's, like, this fine line of care. And I think that's one of the things I really appreciate about the fan fiction community, is it's a community of people that give direct feedback about how believable something is, or, you know, like, if someone didn't read all of the other stories and miswrote this character in some fashion. That's one of the things that, like, I kind of appreciate about the fan fiction community, is maybe to a fault, it's like too caring sometimes about, you know, whether or not someone gets it right. I mean, Kimberly, what do you think about, I mean, what's your thought on fan fiction? Do you think there's some good fan fiction out there, or do you think it all kind of is, you know, derivative and not really that interesting?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I haven't had a lot of experience with reading fan fiction or knowing that that's what I'm reading. But I know, like, as far as my perception, I tend to, and this is coming from a place of ignorance, which I just explained. So that was my disclaimer. But I tend to think of it as being derivative. And then, like you said, I associate fan fiction with, like, people that are really hardcore, what, super fans. And I know sometimes, in other, areas or other arts, like music, for example, that creates this inflexibility. So they want, or their expectation is that you read the text and you saw it exactly the same way that I saw it. So you creating something else in your fan fiction writing that was not there in the text is saying, hey, you didn't read it as closely, or you misunderstood something. And that may not necessarily be the case. It could be that I took something different away, because we bring ourselves to the text anyway, right? So I can only read it through my own eyes and experiences. And, you know, what I got out of it is influenced by who I am. So if I write something, if I write a fan fiction, it may not be something that, you know, you understand or that you got out of the text. And so instead of, you know, maybe being inflexible, you know, be willing to say, hey, you know, well, I didn't get that, or here's a new way to look at it. And if the point of a text or creativity is to spawn creativity, then you have to be willing to kind of respect creativity that wasn't produced by you. So that's what I tend to think of, like, super fans and, like, hardcore, diehard, like, you better not get this wrong, you better not mess it up, which is a bit of a turnoff for me, because I tend to support or have more flexible ideas of what creativity looks like.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you're exactly right. Right, we all bring things to the text. The text should not have any kind of fixed meaning. And I think that's one of the, you know, the negative consequences of some fan fiction is, you know, I think of Star Wars and the backlash of The Last Jedi. And, you know, people were trying to say that it is objectively a bad movie because it has plot holes. It has scenes that don't really make sense. And there's a ton of good movies that have plot holes and have scenes that don't make sense. And so that's, you know, that's such a, to for people to say like something objectively has a meaning or is objectively good or bad, they're not right. And, you know, this came back to Immanuel Kant, and I'm going to be nerdy and professory for a second. And he, you know, he was really interested in trying to determine why people think certain things are beautiful and certain things are not beautiful. You know, he was trying to say, like, is there an objectively beautiful category? And, you know, he said the only way that you can understand beauty is you have to be, he calls it an uninterested observer. And the problem I think that exists in fan fiction communities is they are so invested in the text that there's, you can't judge anything, you know? I mean, that's one of the, you know, that's one of the downsides is, yes, you might get better fidelity to the text, but man, are like, you're right, like there's not a lot of creativity there, because you have a group of people that can't see something new and something beautiful because they're so beholden to, you know, the source text. And I think, you know, we've talked a bit in this class about medium is the message. And the fact that most of these fan fiction exists on like message boards, and message boards have the kind of feel like, you know, internet comments on YouTube and Facebook posts, right? Like people, for some reason, because it's small, it's a small space, they feel like, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out of like why online spaces lend themselves to people being so combative, you know? Because I thought in the early days of the internet, it was because like everyone had weird usernames, right? You could put whatever username you wanted to. But like now we live in a world where, you know, people are commenting using their Facebook profiles, and Facebook makes you, you know, create a real profile with your real picture. But yet that still continues. So Kimberly, what do you think it's about? What about like fan fiction and the form it takes, do you think like causes this kind of community? Because it's definitely, you know, I think a lot of people would describe these communities as kind of toxic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, why do you think that is?
I think it's like the herd mentality, honestly. And I agree with what you said. Like in the early days, the internet, there was this anonymity. You could hide behind this strange handle and nobody could really find out who you were. But now it's like, all right, so there's a community behind people that are being completely indecent or just like hardcore judgmental. So I know if I'm in this space that's dedicated to judging your work and your creativity, and that we're all here to kind of do the same thing, even if I say something that's contrary to all the comments before me, I can almost guarantee there's going to be some people coming behind me that are like, yeah, I was thinking that, but I didn't want to say it. I didn't want to go first. So it's just this level of comfort in all these different communities that have developed online. You're pretty much free to find your people, you know, no matter who those people mm-hmm. are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, and there's, you know, some interesting things about that those early days of the internet that might be better. I just think of like there was a very robust X-Files fanfic community. And a lot of, what happened on the in the fanfic community, ended up influencing, I'm trying to think, it was like the second X-Files movie. I'm trying to remember what that name of that second movie was. Because I think, oh yes, it was I Want to Believe. And that movie came out in 2008, the original X-Files movie in 1998, and that X-Files movie kind of was directly tied into the series, right? I don't know if you ever saw those, but I was obsessed with the X-Files for a while.
Yeah.
But what was really interesting was the second movie, I Want to Believe, was based loosely on some of the fan fiction, and that there was like a standalone story that people wanted to see. And it directly influences the text and shaped what became like a canonical work. And that's why I think that the second X-Files movie feels a little different because it has a different voice. But that was a result of the early days of the internet, where I think the tendency to borrow and play was a little greater. Where, I think the internet now is so, the copyrighted material is so DRM'd and official and branded, that I think it's oftentimes hard to kind of have that intersection between the fan culture and the people making the overall text. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Like even in class, it is intimidating to be asked to kind of handle someone else's work. Even in projects, it's like, well, is this copyrighted? Like, and back in the day, it was hilarious. They'd have these disclaimers like on VCR tapes, on video tapes, like you can't copy, you can't use it, and everybody's like, oh, whatever. And like you said, like on the internet, it was this very playful, creative space. And I don't know, maybe artists were more flexible then because it was the excitement of being able to interact and engage with fans on a very personal level, far and wide. But now everything just seems so litigious and creativity can be very scary. I don't want to even come close to the same creative space that someone else was in. And the territories are marked in ridiculous ways, like seemingly random sometimes. So just like IP law and copyright and all that kind of stuff can be really intimidating for a regular person. And so I think that kind of tamps down creativity, and it's unfortunate.
I mean, I think those early days of the internet, no one could figure out how to commodify it. No one really knew how to control it. And now we have all of these technologies which, simultaneously control and commodify. And that's tough. And I think, I even think of, I mean, maybe this is me and, my own nostalgia, but I just think of, well, I still think that happens in some, I think in most R&B hip hop music always had this great tradition of remixing and combining like backing tracks of different things or borrowing old songs and kind of remaking them new. And I think there's some degree of that now. But I saw more of that in that same age where the internet was also kind of like free and loose. And I wonder what the next thing's gonna be. There's gotta be something else that's gonna come out that is a little more open, that people can kind of play with a little more. Because I think you're right. All of these kind of things really stymie, creativity. Like, if I'm afraid to write a fan fiction or something because, you know, Disney or Fox or someone is going to come after me. Like, I'm not going to do it. And that's kind of sad. Like, what if, you know, what if that fan fiction helps me write like the next great story? And then maybe I can just change the character names, you know? But like, if we're just kind of cutting off that creative energy and not having it, you know, have this out of this nice little outlet, that's going to be tough. You know, because I mean, I think it's easier to make things now. You know, it's easier to make a video, it's easier to do a podcast like this. But at the same point, like the way that you would think there's more stuff out there, but there's not. You know, this is why the top, I'm sorry, I'm ranting, but this is why the top YouTube videos are just people unboxing things. You know, like that's not really creative, but apparently that gets you like millions of hits, right?
Gosh.
And I mean, that's so boring, but like that's dealing with like, you know, commodity. Like it's commodity in its, you know, pure form. It's like unwrapping something.
So I have
And
to
I
ask,
just,
I'm sorry, you said they're unboxing things. Now, because I don't watch YouTube videos for this very reason, are they unboxing things that we already know what's inside the box, or we're waiting on a surprise?
Oh, no, it's, I mean, somewhat. Like, so my niece is obsessed with these things called LOL Surprise. And it's a bunch of junk. It's like the stuff that, you know, we would find, like, you know, when you went to the grocery store and you could put a quarter in. And you got like the little bubble thing with some junk in it. It's this junk from those machines, but it's in this like elaborate packaging that you have to like you know, like unwrap one thing at a time. And so it becomes the process of like unwrapping it is the toy, not the toy itself. But yes, in these videos, it's like, you know, I purchased a American Girl doll. And you can clearly see what the doll is, but I'm just unwrapping it. And like people find, you know, people are really obsessed with that. It came from people used to do the these Kinder chocolates, which you would like crack open. There'd be like a cheap toy. And people used to like just, you know, shoot a video of doing that. And for some reason, there's a couple reasons why. Number one, they're like these safe kid videos. So like when parents just want to put an iPad in front of their kid, it's typically the kind of videos that come up. So anyway, that gets back to our, you know, the previous conversation around like that's not very creative, that's not very interesting, but it's safe. You know, it's like no one's, you know, Mattel's not going to come after you for unwrapping one of their toys. They're going to love it because it's free marketing for them. And I don't understand why people can't get that through about fan fiction. Like sometimes fan fiction will give you more attention to your text than maybe it normally would get. You know, it's like, it's almost like free marketing. And I don't understand why there's this weird tendency around intellectual property. And I think you're right. We're all a little uneasy about it because it's so abstract, you know. It's hard to figure out, well, what exactly is, you know, Harry Potter? What would I be doing to violate Harry Potter? Could I have something in that same world and completely different characters? And because it exists in the same world, is that violating copyright? Like, you know, it might. It depends on like what kind of jury you have or what kind of lawyer you have. And I think that's an uneasy thought. And I think, you know, that we've been talking for a little over half an hour, so we'll need to stop here. But I think this gets into this uneasiness between adaptation and fan fiction. It's like how many elements need to be at play in order for something to be recognizable as an adaptation. Mm-hmm. Do you need a character name? Do you need a setting? Do you need a plot? Do you need a few items? You know, it's, I don't think anyone has a good idea of what that takes. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so uneasy to figure out what is the difference between a fan fiction and adaptation. Kimberly, do you have any final thoughts for us?
I just wonder, you know, especially when people are very, or writers are very defensive about their work and going after people that write fan fiction. It's just interesting that I always think of the saying, there's nothing new under the sun. It's like your work in itself is comparable, I'm sure, in a lot of areas to another story. So this idea that you just generated a wholly original text is insane to me. Don't understand how you can't afford the same opportunity to someone else and, you know, take it as a compliment that, you know, I thought that your work was highly creative. That's one thing. And then another thing, I guess maybe it's a question we can just ponder, is that are these works even intended for the same audience? You know, the original source text and the fan fiction, and does that make any difference?
Yeah, that is a great, great final thought to leave us with. I think that's key, because we teach, you know, when we teach writing, we teach it's all about the audience. And so, yes, I like that question. Thank you so much, Kimberly. This has been a wonderful conversation. So we will be back tomorrow with a new episode. But thank you so much, Kimberly. Great conversation about adaptation.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.